The Cool Scientist is here, Sean Duke, and Sean presents the podcast as well for our curious minds. How are you?
I'm good, Declan, thanks.
Very good, and we'll mention the podcast a little bit later. But in the meantime, one I've been mentioning all morning, that if you live in a detached house, you're more likely to be healthy.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Why?
Why? Well, it has to do, actually, it's really fascinating because the way they hit on this, I mean, they thought, okay, let's see if there's something to do with where we live. And there is some evidence, I suppose, of mental health issues in areas that are not very nice to live in, a very poor, deprived area. So that was research that people knew about. So now they've taken it a stage further and they thought, well, what about people living in detached houses versus non-detached houses, terraced houses or flats? Is there a difference? And lo and behold, researchers, when they did this, they did find that there's a difference. And specifically, they found that there's a big difference in something called C-reactive protein, or CRP, it's known as. And this is a chemical that's linked with stress and inflammation. Inflammation is when your body reacts to disease or stress and kicks in. And sometimes inflammation can be a problem because the body overreacts to a threat. So it seems that people that were living in rented or semi-detached houses and terraced houses or flats, they had nearly double the level of this protein compared to people that were living in detached houses. And what that means in real terms is that people with that are more likely to suffer from cardiovascular disease, which of course means strokes and heart attacks and angina as they get older, compared to people that are living in detached houses. And there's all kinds of theories now that the researchers are trying to come up with for why this is the case. One of them is that green space, of course, it's known that green space is something that reduces stress levels. So they're assuming that detached houses will have a decent garden, maybe where you can sit out in that. And that another theory is that people feel more secure if they're in their own detached house, if you like, because they tend to be homeowners. Homeownership provides security if you're in a flat. If you're renting, of course, that creates stress. So it seems that it's just more stressful to live in a non-detached house.
Okay, you wouldn't be sitting in the garden today now anyway, but that's
but
another matter. Now, this is a new breast cancer calculator. Anything that helps in the fight against breast cancer is to be welcome. But scientists have been looking at this. What have they found?
Yeah, well, breast cancer, as we know, we've got a screening program. It's controversial, of course, here in Ireland. But not every woman wants to get screened or does get screened. And some may not even need to be screened. So this test, this calculator, if you like, that's been developed by Cancer Research UK, which is a very reputable body that funds research in cancer in the UK. Essentially what they've done with this tool is they've brought everything together that might be linked to breast cancer, all the genetic data, because we know some women are susceptible because of their genes, and then there's lifestyle risk. Factors like weight are contributory to cancer, age at menopause is a factor, alcohol, and HRT, hormone replacement therapy, is a factor. We've heard, of course, of the BRAC genes. Many of us will heard of these faulty inherited genes, BRCA1 and 2. They also give an increased chance of breast cancer, but actually there are about 300 different genes. There's loads more that are involved as well in this. So they've taken the whole lot, everything that we know essentially that could be a risk factor for breast cancer in an individual woman, and made it into a cancer prediction tool. And this has been done by Professor Antonis Antoneu, I think is the name. He's a Romanian guy and he's based at the University of Cambridge. And they're saying it could be a game changer, because the idea is that this is going to be farmed out. This test, they're hoping, is going to be used by GPs in the UK, here too maybe, where a woman comes in, all of the elements are put in for her in terms of all the risk factors. She's given a figure, if you like, this is your risk factor, and based on that she can decide whether she wants to go ahead and get screened. Because screening, for one thing, it involves mammograms, which are painful, so that's a bit of a turn off for some women. And then there's another thing, I suppose, which is relevant here in Ireland. Some women are frightened that if they do go and get involved in screening, they might wrongly get diagnosed with cancer, and it's wrong, and it just might be too stressful, and they just don't want to go there. So at least with this, this is saying to the women who definitely need to be screened, listen, your risk is very high. you need to go and get screened. So it might be an additional tool that the GP would have.
Right, so things are moving along. Now, men and women. Right, here we go. Men are more sensitive to pain. Yeah. We experience pain differently.
I'm sure you've heard.
Mine
it.
Is
I'm
worse,
sure
of course.
Every man has heard this, or lots of men have heard this, that, you know, you don't experience pain like we do in childbirth, and this is what I've heard. So we all suffer pain, of course, and the reason that pain exists is that it's evolved to tell us that we're injured. You know, because if you didn't have pain, you'd be going around getting injured and you wouldn't be reacting. And also to avoid things that have hurt us in the past, so we're not going to get hurt again in the future. So that's the reason it exists. Now, there's information that actually, this has been in the background, but now this is what this research is about, that maybe men and women experience pain differently. This research has actually nailed that one and found that yes, they do. And it started initially with research in mice and then it went into humans. And essentially what they did was, they inflicted pain on mice and then they took it into humans, so they did it in humans as well. And they found that when you inflict pain on the males in a room and then you go back, the males in that particular location, if you like, they will experience hypersensitivity to another dose of pain that will last for about 2 days. So if they get a nasty shock, say an electric shock or whatever you want to do, in this case it was acetic acid, they injected the mice with acetic acid, and they found that the male mice were hypersensitive to pain for 2 days afterwards. It made no difference to the women. So, or to women mice, but they did it in humans too. So the thinking is that the males, let's just stick to the humans here, they have a memory of pain that lasts for a couple of days at least, whereas women don't. So men are more sensitive to pain than women. They have a stronger memory of it. And then the question, of course, is why do they have that? And they've linked it then with this hormone that men have called testosterone. So testosterone seems to make us more susceptible, because when they did experiments and they reduced the impact of testosterone, then lo and behold, men and women were the same. So what it says now is that for all kinds of things, let's take pain in cancer or things like that, that actually men and women are not the same. That you cannot apply the same pain relief maybe to men and to women as we have been doing for years, because actually this research is showing they experience pain completely differently and men seem to be more sensitive than women.
All right, that's what scientists get up to. There's another story here, and it is to do with China and the moon. The Chinese have gone to the other side of the moon, not the dark side, the other side, the one that we don't see, and they're doing all sorts of experiments, and now they're planting food.
They're planting food, that's right. This is very clever of the Chinese, and they're really becoming a rival to the US in all kinds of areas, but including space. And this, it was kind of off the radar because it was a Chinese mission, but on the 3rd of January, this Chinese craft landed on the moon. It's called Chang'e 4, lunar lander, and it brought with it seeds of cotton, oilseed rape, potato, etc. And they had seeds, and they grew the seeds while they were up there. This wasn't a manned mission, of course, it was a robotic probe, but they grew the seeds anyway on the moon. And this is really important because, as many people will know, we're planning to go back to the moon. We're also planning to go to Mars. Part of that will involve maybe colonies. They're talking about a moon colony first, the European Space Agency and the Americans. Food, of course, is crucial. So you either, if you're going to have humans going back to the moon or to further still to Mars, which will take you up to 2 years, are you going to bring the food and water with you, or can you, like the Chinese have done, bring seeds and just grow it? And it seems that you can bring seeds. So this has had big implications for our exploration space, because you can bring your seeds with you. And also the Chinese, they grew their plants in this sealed chamber, and the idea is to have a little biosphere, so, you know, a self-sustaining environment where you'll have your oxygen, where you'll have your water, where you'll have your plants, and, you know, it, like Earth is a biosphere, that'll be a self-sustaining environment, and you have your plants on the moon or on Mars that you can actually grow and eat rather than have to carry everything with you. So
you can get a Chinese takeaway on
the
moon
or Mars. Chinese, but you, yeah, maybe, well, rice, that'll be a you'd need lots of water. But there you go. The Chinese have done something that's helping advance the exploration of space.
Right. Okay. Any more? Did you see the one about the coffee that's in the news today?
I didn't see that one.
Most people will think first thing in the morning is the perfect time to have a cup of coffee, but they're wrong. Not only is it actually counterproductive, it can lead people to build a tolerance for caffeine, thereby diminishing its effects down the road. And this is all because our bodies, see, I sound like the scientists here, our bodies create a hormone called cortisol, which is also known as the stress hormone. And it often appears when we're stressed out or worried. But seemingly we have a way of working the circadian clock that they've worked out that this is actually generated by the body. And that's the wrong time to drink coffee, when that's at a high. So they have reporting, whoever has looked into this, that you shouldn't drink coffee before 9 a.m. if you get up. The ideal time to drink coffee is between 10 and 12. That's what I do.
That's what you do, yeah.
And take a break between noon and 2, and you can have a 2 to 5, but that's it. Because the rest of the time, the caffeine is looking after things there where you're drinking the coffee, but the cortisol kicks in when you're not.
Yeah, well, I knew that about cortisol because in studies of people, say, who are depressed, there's apparently, if you're under stress, there's a huge surge of cortisol, the stress thing, in the morning when people wake up. And that's linked in with that. So certainly if you're somebody who's under stress or you're suffering depression or anything like that, you don't want to be taking coffee because it's going to add to that feeling. And I think, well, with me anyway, if I take too much coffee, I tend to feel tired then. It's counterproductive. You know, if you have maybe one or two, there's an optimum. And if you go beyond that, it actually seems to make you exhausted. So you definitely, yeah, one cup at 10 o'clock maybe.
Yeah, well, I have two or three if I can get them. Just one thing on coffee, though. On page 3 of the Irish Independent today, a wake-up call. Climate change threatens 60% of wild coffee species with extinction. So coffee could be gone. This all could be academic as regards cortisol. At least 60% of wild coffee are threatened with extinction, including the species behind one of the most popular beverages, science warned. Researchers at the Royal Botanic Garden in Kew near London have found that 75 of the world's 124 wild coffee species are under threat.
But we're still going to like coffee. I'd say the price will go up. Like, we drink 500,000 cups in Ireland alone, I saw in a report recently. That's an enormous amount for a small country. So it might become even more valuable than cocaine in some of these countries that produce it.
Right, okay. The cool scientist, Sean Duke, and tell us about your Curious Minds podcast.
Well, we've yet, actually, we're taking a week off, Declan, so we're yet to get back, so I'll have to come back to you on that one and let you know next week what we're doing, so we haven't got going yet.
All right, okay. thanks very much indeed to Sean. Sean's own website is sciencespinning.com.